Reading from Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. And let's begin today's reading with a feature entitled, Why Travis Hunter is the Biggest Fish and Fisherman in the Pond. And this feature is written by Sports Illustrated writer Pat Ford. Let me help you, Travis Hunter says, quietly but firmly. Bring him right to me, unquote. We were on a boat in a private lake west of Fort Worth, doing what Hunter loves to do more than anything but playing football. We had driven his Dodge Ram TRX Sandblast Edition pickup on a two-lane road until the houses disappeared, unlocked a gate, and rolled down a gravel path that took us to Hunter's happy place. Surrounded by brown prairie and brown cows, we had come to this brown body of water to catch largemouth bass, and the action had just begun. After feeling the telltale tink-tink tug on my line, I had set the hook with a forceful yank of the rod. Adrenaline surged. The fish flashed his white belly. Then the rush of the moment was interrupted by an urgent problem. The drag on my reel wasn't adequately adjusted to maintain tension on a 4.5-pound bass that was fighting mightily to evade capture. I had just bought the rod and reel upon arrival in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex the day before, and a potentially calamitous error, I hadn't checked the drag. Thus, I was reeling, but not bringing my fish any closer. There was a risk that the line would go slack and that the fish would spit out the artificial worm that I'd caught him with, and one of the biggest bass I'd ever hooked would get away. But as his football career has demonstrated, Hunter is an adept multitasker. He stopped guiding the boat from the bow with the trolling motor and hustled over to the rescue, adjusting my drag while I held the rod and battled the fish. "That's a good one," he said enthusiastically. "Don't lose him. Keep it tight." As I tugged and reeled the bass to the side of the boat, Hunter dropped down to grab the beast by the lower lip and bring it on board. I howled like I had just made a diving interception or hauled in an end zone fade, things that my angling partner did regularly, sometimes in the same game. "Nice fish, dude," Hunter said as he deposited the lunker in the boat's live well. "I told you I was going to put you on the fish. I'm a great teammate. That's my job," unquote. Hunter will have a new job and a new set of teammates soon after his name is called early in the NFL draft. The two-way star from Colorado is the most intriguing and perhaps divisive pro prospect in a very long time, one who played both wide receiver and defensive back full-time in college at an All-American level. Two-way Travis defied 60 years of precedent in doing so, averaging more than 100 snaps a game and he intends to keep defying precedent as a professional. Whichever team drafts Hunter would be foolish to put limitations on him before seeing exactly how much he can handle. There is a school of thought that his best position will be cornerback, with a limited package of plays as a receiver. As of now, Hunter has no interest in those limitations. "I'm not going to let anybody tell me that I can't do something that I've already done," he says. Here's the thing about Travis Hunter. He could be a pro cornerback, a pro wideout, or a pro fisherman. He grew up fishing canals and ponds in Florida. He's an accurate caster with an advanced eye for reading a body of water and deducing where bass might lurk. He understands lure choice, water conditions, and weather variables. He's a quick study, befitting his academic All-American status at Colorado. He pilots a boat with assurance, and just like on the football field, Hunter can go all day. Two-way Travis could actually be three-way Travis if there were no limit on hours in a day or days in a year. Last year, Hunter spent a day on a lake in Florida with Major League Fishing pro Matt Becker, and Becker came away impressed. Quote, "The man definitely has a love for bass fishing," Becker says. "It was super cool to see his passion for it." He started smack-talking instantly. "I could tell he's the ultimate competitor. If he focused on fishing as much as football, he could be a tournament angler," unquote. If it seems like Hunter can do anything, keep in mind what he won't do. He will not be involved in the social ramble, as Satchel Paige once put it. He will not be out on the town until all hours. He will not lose focus on his football future. Since his college career ended, Hunter and his fiancée, Leanna Lene, have relocated to a guest home on the property of Athletic Performance Ranch in Fort Worth. The former cattle ranch is now a sprawling one-stop training shop for athletes in almost any sport. The primary clientele is younger athletes, but professionals and Olympians have come through as well. Anna Cockrell, silver medalist in the 400-meter hurdles in Paris last summer, shared workout space with Hunter one recent morning. There's a huge weight room with an indoor sprint track, a 60-yard outdoor artificial turf field, and across a couple of ponds, a castle-like basketball gymnasium that also includes bunk beds for overnight guests. Hunter has VIP guest privileges, courtesy of Associated Press ranch founder Mike Dry. He's got the guest house that is a short drive from the training facilities, sitting up on a windswept hill. There are some warehouses in view, but that's about it in terms of nearby civilization. "It's still a little too close to everybody," Hunter says. While his tolerance for crowds is low, his tolerance for work is limitless. The training staff at AP Ranch has a million drills to enhance strength, speed, and aerobic conditioning, yet they're still trying to get to the physical bottom of Hunter. "I've worked with a lot of elite athletes, Olympic sprinters, NBA guys, and by far Travis is the most unique," says Greg Scholers, the director of AP Ranch and a former NCAA champion sprinter himself. Quote, "He has the aerobic capacity of an elite middle distance runner or a miler, but he has the sprint speed of a world-class sprinter. He's different. There's been two questions I've never heard him ask. How many? Or are we done? Most people, that's the first thing they want to know. He just goes and goes and goes. we should dedicate his body to science, unquote. Strength and conditioning director Jonathan Gray played running back at Texas and gained more than 2,600 yards after a legendary high school career in the state. He's leaned on Hunter in the weight room without any pushback. He's just a dog, Gray says. The years I played, I thought I was the man with a plan and never got tired. He's on a different level, unquote. Between sets with a medicine ball, heavy ropes, and on an incline bench, Hunter plays with Gray's toddler, Sienna. She's the star of the show at this particular workout, picking up footballs and foam rollers for her personal entertainment. Hunter gravitates to her as a sort of natural buffer between him and the photo and video crews that are filming him for the day. Television screens line the walls above the equipment. When Hunter isn't slapping hands with Sienna, he's looking at the ESPN morning shows, peering through omnipresent glasses that correct his one physical flaw, his vision. My eyesight is trash, he says with a chuckle. NFL topics dominate the morning TV shows, even in March. More than once in recent weeks, Hunter has glanced up to see himself as the topic of debate. The airwaves are full of hot takes about two-way Travis's pro future. It's a blessing to have people debate about me, but it doesn't change anything that I'm going to do, Hunter says. People are only talking about me because my name is hot, so they don't know where I came from, don't know where I grew up. They don't understand my story. I just let people talk, unquote. Hunter says that the neighborhood where he grew up in Boynton Beach, Florida, was bad, but I made the best of it, unquote. Travis Hunter Sr. was a standout high school football player who fathered Travis Jr. as a teenager. His mother, Ferrante Edmonds, made a pivotal decision to move with her husband and four children to suburban Atlanta when Travis Jr. was in his early teens. There was a period of time when the family of six lived together in a single room with two beds at the Metro Extended Stay Hotel in Lawrenceville, Georgia. Later, as his star began to burn brightly at Collins Hill High School, Hunter spent more than a year living with one of the team's assistant coaches. Whatever instability Hunter endured never derailed his love of football and drive to excel. If anything, it might have enhanced it. He was relatively unknown when he committed to Florida State in March of 2020, but he eventually became the number one recruit nationally in the class of 2022. On National Signing Day in December of 2021, Hunter for the first time defied conventional wisdom. He shocked the football world by flipping his commitment to Jackson State, a cut below the top rung of college football and light years removed from the power programs like Florida State. The reason was Deion Sanders. The two had bonded over the love of bass fishing, but their shared football vision was a difference maker. Sanders was in his second season as coach at Jackson State, and he presented a compelling pitch to Hunter. If you want to play both ways at defensive back and wide receiver, learn how from someone who did it at the highest level. There were other elements involved, but the lure of Coach Prime was the prime selling point. Not that Sanders made playing both ways easy. In fact, Hunter's first year at Jackson State was primarily an immersion into playing defense with some dabbling on offense. I had to earn it by playing one side of the ball first, so that's kind of what he made me do, Hunter says. I had to dominate on one side of the ball to be able to get to the other side of the ball. Once he saw that I could do it, he started gradually to put me out there on offense, unquote. By the time Colorado hired Sanders before the 2023 season, Hunter was as much a part of Coach Prime's family as his son Shadur, and Shiloh, a defensive back who could be a late-round selection. They transferred as a package, arriving in Boulder with a lot to prove. Hunter says that his parents are his best friends, but describes Deion Sanders as like a father to me. In Hunter's first FBS game against TCU, he flashed a combination of instinct, awareness, and athleticism that dropped jaws by breaking for a diving interception near the goal line that prevented a Horned Frogs touchdown. Hunter was primarily a defensive back during his first season at Colorado, but he still caught 57 passes for 721 yards and 5 touchdowns. By 2024, he was ready to go the full 60 minutes and 120 snaps on both sides of the ball. The precedent-shattering result, 96 catches for 1,258 yards and 15 touchdowns, 4 interceptions, 11 passes broken up, and 36 tackles. A 9-win season for the formerly downtrodden Colorado Buffaloes, and a runaway Heisman victory. That pushed Hunter to the forefront of NFL draft discussions. For a time, Shadur Sanders was right there with him, but in recent weeks his stock is perceived to be sliding. Miami's Cam Ward is now the consensus top quarterback draft prospect, with Sanders' appeal in question. Hunter has some thoughts on that. It's just hating, Hunter says. They dislike Coach Prime, so they'll try to take shots at us. A lot of people are going to make a mistake if they pass him up, unquote. Not many teams are going to pass on Hunter, who is widely projected as a top three pick. But beyond team interviews at the NFL Combine and working out at Colorado's Pro Day in early April, there isn't a lot more Hunter can do to control where his future lies. So until the draft, he is hunkering down on the Texas prairie to work out and catch fish. Peaceful is Hunter's description of what he likes about fishing, and there certainly can be a calming effect that comes with the quiet. But peaceful doesn't mean passive. Hunter has all the characteristics of a fishing obsessive, always seeking the next pinpoint cast and the next massive strike. As Norman McLean wrote in the seminal fishing novel entitled A River Runs Through It, quote, "Something within fishermen tries to make fishing into a world perfect and apart," unquote. So it is for Travis Hunter. It is his refuge. On the day that we fished together, he kept circling the lake well after our designated stopping time, blowing past the start of a scheduled yoga session back at the ranch. The football stamina easily translates to fishing stamina. There is no stopping. More than finding peace on a lake, Travis Hunter appears to be finding a release from the pressures of being a rising star facing major and uncertain life changes at the age of 21. Out there, rod in hand, nobody else around, doing what he's loved since childhood, he is in command of his surroundings. On this particular day, with a drone camera and a dozen other people watching every move, Hunter finished the afternoon by steering his boat away from it all. He faced the cows on shore, his back to everyone, and kept casting for fish. And again, that feature is entitled Travis Hunter. The Heisman Trophy winner is determined to continue as a star receiver, cornerback, and bass fisherman. Written by Sports Illustrated writer Pat Ford. And in another NFL draft feature, this one focuses on Ashton Jeanty, Boise State's 2,000-yard man, a potential top 10 pick, and is setting out to revitalize the running back position. And this feature is written by Sports Illustrated writer Brian Fisher. A steely visage envelopes his face as Ashton Jeanty makes the transition from resting to training, as if flipping a switch. Eyes focused, his vision narrows. His head moves imperceptibly despite the often violent movement his lower body is going through, whether high-stepping through warm-ups or sprinting on a treadmill. The Boise State tailback, he's still sporting a blue pullover with the school's logo, is nothing if not consistent when it comes to putting in work. Jeanty can often be found in a zen-like state, concentrating on that opening just ahead of him on the field, and like a mathematician in a movie rapidly calculating angles and distances on how he can best locate the optimal path forward with a ball tucked against his ribs. This approach, one that often winds up with him in the end zone on an actual football field, is something that Jeanty has been refining over the course of his still young career in the backfield. It is also a key factor in explaining why he's entering the NFL draft, certain to become more than just a first-round pick at a position that tends to get labeled as quote-unquote devalued as soon as it is mentioned. Jeanty will have none of that talk. He sees himself not only as a difference maker, but also part of a growing wave of players that have made it in vogue again to carry the ball and become the focal point of an offense. Quote, "They've been saying it's a running back renaissance, and I believe it's here," says Jeanty. "All those guys in the league, it's great to see them bringing life back into the position. I mean, it's not just me. Plenty of other guys are doing special things," unquote. If there's a leading man for the rushing revival, it's Philadelphia Eagles star Saquon Barkley. Following his very public swap in NFC East alliances last year after he left the Giants, the now highest-paid player at the position in the league ignited the debate with a 2,005-yard season capped off with a Super Bowl victory. The likes of Jahmyr Gibbs of the Lions, Derrick Henry of the Ravens, and James Cook of the Bills have fueled the movement as they put up big numbers. Those three, all of whom were among the 16 backs who rushed for at least 1,000 yards last season, the most since the year 2010, have contributed to the altering of the narrative regarding their position. But it remains to be seen if NFL front offices are truly changing their stance towards running backs, or if recent chatter is merely a blip in a decade-long trend of decline on the field and almost as important within the salary cap. We live in a copycat league, and as running backs moved around this past offseason, people found greater value in the position itself, unquote, says one NFC personnel executive. But beauty is going to be in the eye of the beholder, he added. Such thinking is about to be put to the test during this year's draft, where Jeanty, whom Sports Illustrated projects to go sixth, which would be the highest spot for a running back since Barkley went second overall in 2018, leads one of the deepest classes in recent memory. Jeanty is atypical off the field as well. He's an accomplished cook who enjoys singing and dancing so much that he's already planning which songs he will perform when he's subjected to various NFL rookie rituals. He often posts dances to his TikTok account, which has 700,000 followers. Of course, he also likes to relax by playing video games, with Call of Duty his favorite choice. That might not seem like something to wind down to, but it's in keeping with the attitude that the back displays on game day. "I'm vicious. I'm vicious when I run the ball," he says. "All those guys in the NFL, they're great at making guys miss. I feel I'm a little more physical. That's just my mentality when I play, to dominate the man across from me," unquote. Genty is not shy in ticking off his individual goals. He would like to earn Rookie of the Year honors and amass more than 2,000 all-purpose yards. Naturally, the hope is that comes in tandem with team success, as he believes he can be a plug-and-play option for whatever franchise drafts him. "Everything you want in a running back, I can do," he says. "Speed, power, agility, and most importantly for a running back, running the ball and making people miss. In the passing game, I can catch the ball, I could run routes like a receiver. Then, being an extension of the O-line in pass protection and picking up a blitzer, giving the QB time to throw the ball down the field. From an IQ standpoint, understanding our offense and understanding how defenses attack us. Then, character. I think that's the most important, who I am as a person. I strive for excellence each and every single day. I'm special not just on the field, but off the field. I'm one of a kind," unquote. "One of a kind" is not a phrase that many coaches use to describe Genty early in his football career. His father was a commanding officer in the Navy, which led to a winding path to the cusp of NFL stardom. He grew up in Jacksonville before making stops in Virginia and, most notably, a base just outside of Naples, Italy. It was there, in a country's home to a much different brand of football, that the tailback first started to make a name for himself. Between an 18-hour bus ride to play a game in Germany and a flight across the Mediterranean to Spain, it wasn't a convenient setting for learning the nuances of a game, but it helped develop the young expat's love of something uniquely American. His success also made Genty and his parents acknowledge what the game of football could mean to his future. With encouragement from relatives back home and friends abroad, the family returned to the U.S., settling in suburban Dallas so Genty could live up to his full potential on the field. Playing in the ultra-competitive world of Texas high school football, Genty wasted little time in making an impression at Lone Star High School in Frisco. But playing time at his preferred spot in the backfield was limited due to older players on the roster. Genty wound up playing all three levels on defense, which gave him a greater understanding of pursuit angles. Coaches lined him up as a slot receiver as well, forcing him to develop his route running as a replacement for current Denver Broncos wideout Marvin Mims Jr., who had graduated. Eventually, Genty was handed full-time running back duties, breaking out with 41 touchdowns in 12 games as a senior. "I was always seeing myself playing in the NFL," he says. "I was just naturally good at football and just always enjoyed it. I got to a point where I saw where I knew I could really do something with this and really have a future," unquote. Lone Star coach Jeff Rayburn says that Genty never complained about the circuitous route to playing tailback, but concedes that it probably hampered Genty in the eyes of college recruiters. Ivy League offers poured in, but interest among FBS teams was slim going into Genty's final season in 2021. The pandemic did not help matters. Boise State was the exception. The Broncos offered Genty after a summer workout on the school's famous blue turf and then fended off bigger names who came around late in the process. I remember the first time that I saw him, I was like, holy smokes, this dude is built different, Boise State coach Spencer Danielson says. His first spring game scrimmage, it's 4th-and-1, and Ashton's getting reps with our starting offense against our starting defense. He breaks this 75-yard touchdown run. Mind you, I'm the defensive coordinator, and I remember being pissed in the moment, but then also being like, hey, that dude's going to be real special, unquote. Genty came into his own as a sophomore, finishing 2nd in the nation in yards from scrimmage, which earned him All-American honors and the Mountain West Offensive Player of the Year award. After powering Boise State to a surprising league title in the process, the transplanted Texan received plenty of interest and six-figure NIL offers to move elsewhere to elevate his profile. He says he never considered entering the transfer portal, instead showing up at 6 a.m. in the snow when the Broncos' off-season workouts got underway. I felt like I had everything that I wanted to accomplish, which, most importantly, was developing myself into becoming one of the best running backs so that I could play in the NFL, Genty says. I had every single thing that I needed. There was no question in my mind that I was supposed to stay at Boise State, unquote. Strength coaches were impressed with how his side won virtually every rep in competitive matches of tug-of-war, and teammates gravitated to the natural leader. Coaches limited his carries in practice, not just to keep Genty fresh, but also so their own defense could actually get work in. The results were astonishing. Genty ran for 2,601 yards last season, coming just 27 yards shy of Barry Sanders' 36-year-old single-season record. There were times when Dirk Cotter, the former Buccaneers head coach who served as the Broncos play caller, would mutter in disbelief into his headset during a game when the tailback would escape a defensive straitjacket. Others on staff would excitedly offer their own touchdown calls, sometimes before Genty even received the ball. As an offensive coach and somebody that's involved in the run game, it's pretty comforting knowing that you're going to hand the ball to him because good things are going to happen, says Nate Potter, a former NFL lineman who is now the team's offensive coordinator. Genty topped 100 yards on the ground in all 14 games and had 1,970 yards after contact in 2024. The school says that he forced an unfathomable 164 missed tackles. Not everything was easy, however. Boise State went 12 wins, 1 loss, and won the Mountain West title game, which gave the Broncos a bye into the college football playoff quarterfinals against Penn State. Against the Nittany Lions, Genty fumbled twice, losing one, and was held to 3.5 yards per carry in a 31-14 loss. Finishing as runner-up to Travis Hunter for the Heisman Trophy remains a touchy subject as well. Quote, all throughout life, all throughout sports, things aren't always going to go your way, Gentee says. I'm past that now. I'm just getting ready to be one of the best running backs in the league, unquote. That process began right after the new year when Gentee moved near a training facility north of Atlanta along a handful of other potential draft picks. At 5'8", he was far from the biggest back in that group. Clemson tailback Phil Maffa stands nearly a head taller, but he was easy to spot. You just had to look for the NFL film cameras, which were tracking him for a documentary. It's easy to see why cameras love Gentee. He moves with a purposeful fluidity. Every cut, every leap, every stretch is done with an eye towards setting up the next motion. You want a guy that's got vision. You want a guy that has contact balance, says new Dallas head coach Brian Schottenheimer when asked about the demands of the position. The fronts that we're facing require guys to be able to make hidden yards. Whether there's a free safety in the hole or there's a linebacker or a defensive lineman coming off a point of attack, you've got to have a guy who is willing to run through arm tackles, unquote. Though Schottenheimer wasn't speaking directly about the back who went to high school a stone's throw from the Cowboys' headquarters, he could have been. Take Gentee's favorite run from this past season against Washington State. It's the first quarter, and Gentee is in the pistol for a simple zone play, standing straight up in the familiar position that prompted Mems likening him to Halloween terror Michael Myers. Quarterback Maddox Madsen takes the snap and immediately hands off to Gentee. A split second later, a defensive tackle leaps past Boise State's right guard but can only wave at Gentee. A linebacker shoots the A-gap and actually gets a hand on Gentee, but he winds up spinning around the ball carrier's hip and lands flat on his back. A defensive end sheds his block and tries to stick out an arm onto Gentee's shoulder pads, while a safety coming up in run support goes low in an attempt to take the back out at the knees. Gentee politely shoves them aside, but the brief pause allows three more Cougars to converge on him. Gentee quickly sidesteps the three, who bang into each other like something out of a cartoon, then bounces outside and pulls away from two defenders for a 64-yard touchdown. Ashton Gentee puts people in conflict every time he takes the ball, because you don't know how to tackle him. You're in conflict as a defender, Danielson says. If you come high thinking he's going to cut on you, he'll run you over like a freight train. If you come low bracing for impact, he's got the top-end explosiveness to make one cut and he's out. He puts everybody in conflict consistently, unquote. As Gentee's workout ends and morning becomes afternoon, he changes into a simple black shirt that frames the word disruptive in large white lettering. It's a nod to the sports agency he signed with, but it is also an appropriate label for what he envisions himself doing in the league at a position that some have written off. Quote, turn on the tape if you have any second thoughts, unquote, he says. And again, that feature is entitled Ashton Gentee, Boise State's 2,000-yard man, is setting out to revitalize the running back position. Written by Sports Illustrated writer Brian Fisher. And in another NFL draft feature from Sports Illustrated, this one's entitled Tennessee Titans Cam Ward selection is the ultimate test for Brian Callahan. Tennessee has a new regime in place and a new stadium on the way. Now it has a potential franchise quarterback taken with the number one pick. And this feature, written by Connor Orr of Sports Illustrated. In one season as Tennessee Titans head coach, Brian Callahan exhibited a kind of unhinged honesty when it came to his quarterback, Will Levis. Granted, this was completely understandable. Levis's penchant for altering the game by doing something memorably dangerous and ill-advised was quickly becoming legendary. Just as the game would seem to be headed in a conventionally positive direction, Levis would play his body out in a completely horizontal fashion and fire the ball backward or drift into pocket pressure and flick the ball towards an oncoming defender or exist on the unfortunate end of some communication breakdown with a wide receiver, making it look like he was purposely firing a football towards an opponent. At one moment, caught on camera, Callahan approached his quarterback on the field and earnestly asked, "Hey, what the F are you doing?" Unquote. After that game, a Week 2 loss to the New York Jets, Callahan said of Levis's quarterback play, "It was dumb. It was the same exact thing he did last week, and he cost us points in the red zone. He's a grown-up, and he knows better, and so I was really irritated that he cost us 3 points in a game that we probably needed it," unquote. Regardless of your takeaway, the correct read on Tennessee's quarterback situation a year ago was that Coach Callahan could behave that way because he knew that Levis wouldn't be his problem for much longer. Levis was an inherited quarterback who was not drafted in the first round. The coach who had drafted Levis had already been let go, and it was a matter of months before the general manager who selected him would also be out the door. Most coaches interested in developing a young quarterback would refrain from calling their play dumb or dressing them down on the field in such a particularly demeaning way. Again, we're not blaming Callahan, but we say that on the night that Tennessee has drafted its next franchise quarterback, Miami's Cam Ward, with the number one pick, to say this. Now we'll find out what the Titans truly have at the head coaching position. It would seem to be a fireable offense for Callahan to say the same of Ward's play or unleash the same kind of body language on the sideline. The Titans have made an effort to display how convicted the team has been in Ward all along. Rolling with his inevitable rookie moments is now underlined and cemented as part of the job description. With a new stadium opening in the year 2027 and the need to fill that stadium with human beings, this pick is obviously bigger than one person. But it begins with the offensive coach so sought after that the Titans wouldn't let him leave the building to take another interview elsewhere. Callahan rose to prominence as the operator behind the scenes of Joe Burrow's massive star rise. His inability to get much out of Levis, Callahan was much nicer to him in interviews and on the sidelines later in the season, by the way, was either inevitable due to Levis's high variance play or the precursor to questioning whether he's up for the magnitude of this turnaround in the first place. Luckily, Cam Ward is the ultimate test. He is neither as irresponsible with the football as Lewis nor as flawless as Burrow. There are just enough head-scratching moments to coach out of him. A totally sidearm cross-body pick against Florida last year stands out, but more than enough physical tools to help Ward get away with dropbacks that may not appear to be technically perfect. In short, he's a quarterback who seems to be possibly good enough if the offense that's built for him is good enough. What's most interesting to me about Ward is that I think people are missing the point on a Patrick Mahomes comparison that has followed him throughout the past season. Ward isn't necessarily Mahomes, but he is obviously one of the first Mahomes generation quarterbacks to make it big. Ward was 14 years old, just entering his formative years as a quarterback when Mahomes was drafted. He was 16 when Mahomes started taking over the NFL as a full-time starter. Ward has some of that foot quickness and functional mobility. He has a hose for an arm that seems to work at any angle. In this offseason of veteran quarterback movement, the Titans didn't have to commit to Ward as aggressively as they did. They didn't have to make the selection such a foregone conclusion that Ward recently listed Treylon Burks as one of his top five receivers in the NFL during a Twitch stream. Given Cam Ward's isolation in this draft class as the one quarterback truly befitting of a first-round pick, the Titans could have flipped the number one pick, made a play for Jimmy Garoppolo or Matthew Stafford or Aaron Rodgers or Kirk Cousins or Joe Flacco or Daniel Jones and taken their chances in a future class. But the Tennessee Titans didn't do that, which means that they saw Ward as being that special, and that Coach Callahan agreed with that assessment, and that Callahan's performance last year with Levis can be most accurately blamed on the quarterback. At least the Titans hope so. And again, that feature is entitled Tennessee Titans Cam Ward Selection is the Ultimate Test for Brian Callahan, written by Sports Illustrated writer Connor Orr. And from football news, let's turn to some baseball news. This next feature is entitled Six Reasons for the Chicago Cubs' Shocking Offensive Turnaround. Fans may have been upset with Chicago's quiet offseason, but their early success at the plate shows the danger of viewing roster improvement solely in terms of payroll. And this feature written by Sports Illustrated writer Tom Verducci. The Chicago Cubs have the highest scoring offense in baseball. That qualifies as one of the most shocking developments in April, given that they have led the National League in runs once in the past 35 years, 17 years ago. And after ranking 12th in Major League Baseball last year, just about all they did last winter was swap out Cody Bellinger for Kyle Tucker and spend just $19 million on free agent bats for veteran role players Justin Turner, Carson Kelly, and John Birdie. How good have they been? This good. First, the Cubs are scoring 6.27 runs per game. That's simply unsustainable. You must go back to the year 1935 to find a Cubs team that scored even 5.5 runs per game. The highest scoring Cubs team in the past 90 years is the 97-win team of 2008, which scored 5.31 runs per game. This one may be that good. Next, they are running wild. The Cubs lead the majors in stolen bases with 40 and stolen base success rate at 87%. The 40 steals are a franchise record for the month of April. It's the first time in 110 years that the Cubs have stolen 40 bases in the first 26 games. They ran the Dodgers off the field this past week in a two-game sweep at Wrigley. Also, the Cubs have hit 38 home runs, just three short of the franchise record for April, set in the year 2000 and matched in the year 2019. And no team in history has the Cubs' combination of home runs and stolen bases through 26 games. What in the world is going on at the corner of Clark and Addison? It's a good example of why people should be careful putting so much emphasis on payroll when it comes to, quote, what my team did to improve, unquote. Here are the reasons why the Cubs' offense is scorching hot, none of which tie directly to money spent. First, manager Craig Counsell established a strong base-running culture in spring training. Counsell has an athletic, speedy team. He drilled home in spring camp that base-running would help win. It's something that we emphasized, Counsell said. They should be good at it, unquote. The culture has carried into the season. The Cubs have frequent video review sessions to point out smart base running plays and the occasional mistakes and missed opportunities. Like high school football film sessions, he jokes. The Cubs are the best base running team in baseball, and it's not even close. StateCast rates them as 15 net bases gained. The Milwaukee Brewers are next best at 10. Secondly, starting with a change last July, Pete Crow Armstrong has blossomed into an impact hitter. Crow Armstrong was hitting 169 through his first 78 games in the big leagues when, last July, hitting coach Dustin Kelly came up with an idea. The Cubs were in Kansas City. Crow Armstrong had hit rock bottom. He was 0 for 17. He was getting the bat knocked out of his hands. Crow Armstrong was hitting with almost no leg lift. He liked to glide into the baseball. Kelly recognized the problem. As Crow Armstrong's front foot stepped forward, his head and torso followed his foot. He was drifting. In doing so, he was creating less time for himself, literally shortening the distance to see and hit the ball, and losing any power from his backside. Coach Kelly brought Crow Armstrong into the batting cage in Kansas City and showed him a drill. He had him drift his front knee in the load phase and told him to feel the stacked position of his backside. Then they progressed to swings from that trigger mechanism, keeping his head behind the ball. Crow Armstrong almost immediately took that drill into game action, an extraordinary mid-season adjustment done on the fly. It's an indication of Crow Armstrong's athleticism that he pulled off the change so quickly, and the results have been stunning. Crow Armstrong has lengthened the Cubs' lineup. Always an elite defender in center field, Crow Armstrong may develop into a Jim Edmonds-like impact player. And next for the Cubs is a second swing change. Miguel Amaya also is a different hitter this year. Amaya reached the big leagues with a powerful swing, but one that had excess movement. To generate more power, the Cubs catcher lifted his front knee as he yanked his hands back. All that movement did was get him a 198 batting average. Coach Kelly saw a hitter with so much bat speed that he didn't need the excess movement. So after a game on July 3rd, Kelly and Amaya decided to simplify things. Instead of a big leg kick, Amaya spread his stance a bit and simply kept his front toes on the ground and lifted his heel, a trigger similar to the one that Albert Pujols used. Dustin Kelly is a former minor leaguer in the Red Sox system, where he played with Cubs pitching coach Tommy Haudovy. He served as a coach and instructor for 7 years on the Southern California amateur scene before the Dodgers hired him as a minor league hitting coach, and the Cubs hired him 3 years ago. And the Cubs' Carson Kelly is also a different hitter. This swing change predated the Cubs. Carson Kelly hit a career low in August of 2023 when the Arizona Diamondbacks released him. The catcher signed with the Detroit Tigers, who took a deep dive into his swing mechanics and suggested some changes, especially with his setup. Those changes, featuring a lower set of his hands and less rollover of his wrists, began to take root last year, including after a trade to Texas in July. But he still wasn't hitting the ball very hard. When the Cubs in December signed him to a 2-year, $11 million contract, few people noticed. Kelly was 30 years old and, after over 1,800 plate appearances, was a career 224 hitter. This year, with some minor tweaks to the swing changes he started last year, Kelly has gone off with a 342 batting average and is crushing the baseball like never before. And finally, Wrigley Field is playing small. Wrigley Field turned 111 years old this week. She looks as charming as ever, though every hitter knows she can be temperamental depending on which way the wind blows. Last season, only T-Mobile Park in Seattle played bigger than Wrigley. This month, it has been hitter-friendly. It continues an every-other-year pattern of how the park plays. And again, this is a list of reasons for the Cubs' shocking offensive turnaround, written by Sports Illustrated writer Tom Verducci. And that's all the time that we have for this reading from Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Sports Illustrated. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.